Hi, good morning. It's quite an honor to be here. It's a huge topic, sustainability, and of course I'm going to try to cover it all in just a very short time, so I'll get right to it. I want to start with the easy part. These are usually considered something like the three pillars of sustainability, that agriculture or biomass production should be environmentally sound, economically profitable, and socially just. Does anybody disagree with these principles? No, I didn't think so. So, well, that's the easy part of sustainability. The hard part, it's not that simple, however, if really when you start to dig down into what we actually mean when we think about environmental justice or social justice or environmental soundness, there are always conflicting perspectives about what that means. And when you do changes, do regulations, or try to adopt sustainability regs, you have winners and losers. And it's very difficult sometimes in complex systems to predict the outcome. So what are we thinking about? I'm going to be talking primarily about agriculture and agriculture as a source of feedstocks today. So we actually want agriculture to do a lot of different things. We certainly want it to produce food. We want it to provide a sound and diverse diet. We want farmers to do well when they do agriculture and be profitable. We want to not undermine our resource base. We want to maintain our soils. We have to use our fossil fuels and other resources prudently. We have to maintain habitat. There are trade-offs among all of these things. So now we're in the process of adding a new demand to agriculture, which is to produce feedstocks for fuel and for energy, which is actually not a new demand. Historically, agriculture always did it, but for our agriculture, it's a new demand. And when you add a new demand, you're going to have some adjustments among all those other features. The outcome of those adjustments will vary also depending on scale. So, for example, what makes the best management practice or a sustainable practice at the field level may not be quite the same thing that functions sustainably at the farm level. Sustainable farm practices may not be the same from a societal perspective, from a point of view of sustainability. In other words, where sometimes our growers are using, for instance, fertilizers at a certain level and discharging emissions to nature, to the waterways, and that, in fact, is perfectly good business practice for them, but not necessarily for society as a whole. So the level at which we look at sustainability also will affect our perspective and outcome. So I have about three large subject areas that I want to try to touch on, at least. My hope is that this will help provide some context for the rest of the day. Fundamentally, if we're going to use agriculture as a source of feedstocks, be they residues or purpose-grown crops, we have to have systems that are efficient. Well, what does that mean? We also have to have systems that continue to be efficient or to improve over time. So what we would like, what we would call efficient in this sense and sustainable in this sense, is a system that has increasing outputs, higher and higher yields or outputs, with lower and lower inputs. The opposite would be if we're putting more and more into our farming systems and getting less and less. That's clearly not sustainable. So the gold standard is increasing output for decreasing input. Is that even possible? Well, in fact, it is and has been, and it marks agricultural progress in the last century particularly. One of the great papers that I've read, and I think it's a classic, is Resource Use Efficiency. That was the last paper that Case DeWitt wrote and published in 1992, and it has it all in there. And he points out that when you do intensification in agriculture, it's not changing just fertilizer levels or tillage practices. It's all of them together, and doing them all together gives you a positive interaction, which means that the outcome can be greater than the effect from one particular change at all. So this is maize, and we don't use maize. Well, we are using maize now for some biodiesel, for corn oil for biodiesel, but basically this is from the Corn Growers Association, and they've calculated that you're using less land, losing less soil, using less irrigation water, less total energy, and have fewer emissions per bushel of corn now than you used to 20 or 30 years ago. Well, this is, of course, an advocacy group, but there's been a lot of comment in the scientific literature. This paper from PANS that points out that agricultural intensification has had a very beneficial effect on reducing greenhouse gas intensity over the last half decade or so. And, in fact, that is, in fact, a true outcome. One of the other significant consequences of intensification, especially looked at historically, is the reduction in the amount of land needed to produce the food, feed, and now fiber, and now fuel that humans rely on. This is a stunning change. It used to be that to have more cropland, that to have more crops, you had to have more land. It's still somewhat true. We are certainly expanding land, especially in South America, in the Black Sea region of the world. It's another important area that's improved production significantly. But still, the amount of land needed per person and per capita for food production is substantially less. And to protect nature, there's no avoiding the need for intensification. Here's just a picture of land change that is occurring. Here's soybean production in Brazil at the edge of the forest. That goes on, but to preserve nature at all in a resource-demanding future, we have to be able to rely on intensification. So the U.S. relies on maize for ethanol and soybean oil for biodiesel in a large way. Does this make sense, and do we think it might continue? Well, why is it? Why is it happening? The main reason, I think, has got to do with yield increase and the fact that the U.S. has had historically very expensive and costly surpluses of both corn and soybeans over time. This is a phenomenal achievement, really. If you step back and think about it, you have an 8-fold increase in corn yields and a 4-fold increase in soybeans, basically in the same climate and soil zones. We see the production then of biofuel facilities, particularly corn ethanol facilities in the American heartland where maize production is centered, and to a lesser degree, some concentration of biodiesel facilities in the same region, though biodiesel can be made from many other things besides, obviously, vegetable oils. And the technologies that have been used, no-till farming, precision agriculture, transgenic crops, and other efficiencies have gone into both maize and soybean production to sustain those yield increases and sustain improving yield efficiency. One of the major adoptions in the U.S. has been the use of herbicide-tolerant and other transgenic traits in crops. Soybeans, it's almost 100%. And maize, it's over 70% now. Irrigation is also another feature that's critically important for the production of crops. Certainly it is in my state in California. Most of the 10 million acres of cropland in California is irrigated and couldn't be operated in the same way without irrigation. For maize and to some degree for soybeans, a lot of irrigation occurs in Nebraska. Just want to say a word about this. There are those who would categorically argue that there should be no irrigation of feedstocks for biofuels. But irrigation provides us with is one of those inputs to agriculture that improves efficiency substantially. In other words, you eliminate some of the risks associated with weather variation. That means you can better optimize all other inputs to your system. So to categorically to exclude that one use for just that one purpose for a particular crop, like maize can be irrigated for food but not for fuel, doesn't make any sense to me. But the picture's not entirely rosy, clearly. I'm not here to say that our agriculture, as we practice it, is without problems. Clearly it's not, and there's a need to get better. And basically there's kind of a dilemma agroecologically. The more intensively we farm, the higher the risk of emissions losses there are. So somewhere, it's our job as agronomists, it's our job as agricultural ecologists to try to find some balance between high rates of throughput or intensification and some need to control emissions or to create cropping systems that reduce those emissions. That's an ongoing task. In fact, it's what I consider my job to be. So just for example, We have problems. This is an outline of the state of Iowa. There are parts of the state of Iowa where soil erosion remains a significant problem. Even with no-till and reduced tillage agriculture, we still find areas in the state that are threatened or lead to excessive erosion. And we know that from the Mississippi River drainage, there are large amounts of fertilizer losses that occur and lead to deposition of nitrogen in the Gulf, with the consequence of anoxia and other and whatever consequences that has for fisheries and wildlife in general in those areas. Now, the interesting thing is that the loss of nutrients from the upper Midwest is in part facilitated by tile drainage, which we put in deliberately to improve the efficiency of our farming systems. So these are real dilemmas that affect sustainability. It's not that we can't continue to find gradual improvements into this system, and perhaps through improved regulation as well, help retard some of these losses. Nonetheless, there are real benefits from the very thing that causes this problem. So how can we measure sustainability? I think there's a good paper that's a few years old now, 1996, by Hansen, again in Agricultural Systems, called "Is Sustainability a Useful Concept for Agriculture?" And he makes the larger point that in discussing sustainability, we have to use our language clearly. We have to think about what our terms mean. We have to be careful to define the boundary conditions that we're talking about, and we have to be careful not to use qualitative terms for quantitative phenomena. He does a nice job, and I think his classification system is still good. You can categorize definitions of sustainability as philosophical or ideological, or as ability to follow a set of strategies. You can talk about a sustainability definition as simply fulfilling a set of goals, or the simplest and the thing that I like best when talking about sustainability as a definition is the ability to continue over time. For example, there are people that argue that organic farming, if you farm organically, you are sustainable. It's synonymous. So that means if you follow the rules that define organic farming label and you're certified, you are sustainable. Now, this has implications for certification for biofuels as well. So what you have is a set of standards. You follow the rules. Yes, you're sustainable. No, you're not. The problem is this is kind of a circular logic. If you define sustainability by definition and you adhere to it, how do you know, in fact, that the practices that you're following are in fact sustainable or beneficial over time? It makes for a poor guide for research and a poor guide, in my view, for a standard for certification. Hansen likes this kind of way of thinking about sustainability as a guide to research and perhaps even for certification systems. In other words, sustainability should have a literal meaning. It should mean that we are able to continue and to advance through time. It should be thought of as a systems-oriented property. It has to be defined with respect to a particular agricultural system with well-defined boundaries and components. And it should have some quantitative character. We have to be able to measure some of the properties that we're talking about and compare them. We have to be looking at trends over time, not just simply a condition or state at a particular point in time. So here's a kind of a complicated model. But I think this is, in fact, needed if we're going to be able to really talk in a sensible way about sustainability. I think there has to be an iterative process that links models that we use to project future states with a database that includes long-term research, which is, in fact, our basis for or proof of our model concepts. These have to be linked to landscape scale, process dynamic models, and to economic analysis to support decisions. And you have to have an iteration between the model and the experiment. There are other ways to gather data that can validate ecosystem models as well, but long-term research is essential if we're going to be looking at changes over time. Are the changes positive or negative of a set of practices? What about biofuels and carbon regulation and sustainability? This is obviously a big issue right now. We all know about the Mauna Loa curve. It's very clear that greenhouse gases are increasing. You're going to have a very interesting panel about this over the in the next part of the morning following me. We know this. Everybody knows that fossil energy is essential to or the basis for the life we live. This is just a picture of New York City. Could you imagine New York City as it is without a substantial fossil energy subsidy? I can't imagine this hotel that we're in without a substantial fossil energy subsidy. The character of modern life is at stake when we talk about the regulation of carbon emissions. Clearly, the IPCC and other groups have been active in trying to warn the world about what is perceived to be a substantial risk of rapid and uncontrolled alteration of global climate and ecosystems. Is it a big problem or a little problem? Are glaciers melting, lakes drying up, wildfire incidences increasing in the West or not? Well, I created what I call the Dyson-Hansen scale, and you can decide for yourself where you belong on it. Up on the right is James Hansen and our ex-Governor Schwarzenegger and Vice President Gore. On the bottom left is Freeman Dyson, who is one of the more well-known persons who is doubtful about how urgent and serious this issue is. And I put Bjorn Lomborg on there. You can line yourself up there somewhere. We all have to decide where we're going to, how serious and how urgent this problem is. California, where I come from, has assumed that global climate change will be catastrophic, will have very, very significant consequences. And so it passed the Global Warming Solutions Act. You can see Governor Schwarzenegger ending global warming there. So you can all go home. Isn't that great? There's two important regulations that are particularly affect fuels. One is the Global Warming Solutions Act, particularly the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, and then there's an investment plan, the Alternative and Renewable Fuel Technology. Both these laws have mandates to develop sustainability standards. They also have mandate a significant reduction in the carbon emissions per person. This is a tenfold, nearly a tenfold reduction of carbon emissions in California. And no one really knows whether we'll be able to do that or how we'll get there. The Energy Information Agency suggests that this will not be possible based on their projections, but nonetheless, this is California's pathway. There's the Energy Information Information's recent analysis of what the projections are for energy use and emissions per capita over time. I don't see a tenfold reduction in that trend. So that California really has set itself a significant task. I think this is going to have all kinds of consequences that people aren't necessarily going to be happy about. So but nonetheless, it's there. Basically, the Low Carbon Fuel Standard requires a gradual reduction, not so gradual in the next few years, actually, in the carbon intensity of gasoline and diesel. It uses a life cycle assessment process to establish what the carbon intensity of various pathways are. This is some recent ones that affect biodiesel. Really, there's a lot to see, but you may notice all the way on your right as you look at that, the category of percent better than petroleum with indirect land use change, and you can see soil biodiesel isn't really much better than petroleum with indirect land use change. These numbers are in flux. Some of them, I think, are particularly bogus. For instance, the use of corn oil, the way it's calculated, as I understand it, has no effect on the feeding value, the DGS from which the corn oil is removed, and there's no land cost for the production of that corn oil. It's all carried by the ethanol side. These are simply arbitrary decisions, in my view. The RFS2 is another law, as you all know. You're more probably familiar with that from this in this part of the U.S. It has a mandate for certain amounts of production. I know you're making it already for biodiesel and can easily do that in the U.S., but it also has a mandate for advanced ethanol and for biocellulosic ethanol, and that mandate is not being met in any path that looks like it's likely to be met, and it was our judgment at the National Academy that a scientist study that we're on that it will not be met in all likelihood. Now, this comment comes from two ecologists from the University of Minnesota, Jason Hill and Tillman. And they would. This is their sense for what would be a really great way to try to meet, for example, that cellulosic biomass mandate, and generally think that it would be better if biofuel feedstocks were produced with low ag inputs and on land with low agricultural value. I have question marks there because we've just gone through the talk about intensification and how that's essential, and that it could be converted to biofuel with little energy. Well, that would be great if that could happen. But the RFS2, in fact, kind of works against that. And this comes from a colleague named Bill Hudson from the Pro Exporter, who kind of figured out that, in fact, the land that's eligible for RINs, as defined by the EPA, is slightly different from USDA's estimate of land. Not only is the amount less, where it's located and where accessible and available land might be in the U.S. Differs. And the EPA is the determining party. The EPA gets to decide. So the cropland pasture base in the EPA database is mostly in the western arid region, in western states that are highly arid, not necessarily places where one would expect pretty abundant yields or high yields per unit effort. North Carolina and Florida is actually has anomalously large amounts of land where that would qualify under EPA's database. So does North Carolina. So Florida might be pretty well off. If you overlap those figures with estimates of where switchgrass, for example, would be most readily produced with highest yields, you see that the majority of those is actually somewhat to the east in the American heartland, though Florida has a large area that would looks like it could produce a lot of switchgrass if you were to divert the landscape to that purpose. And this really get rid of that. Don't want to end the show. There we go. The area where switchgrass is thought to grow well is also the area where we grow most of our crops. So basically what looks like is happening is that the RFS is going to force production of some of this cellulosic material into the same land area where we grow our high-value annual crops. In other words, and it's very unlikely to see that happening without high opportunity costs and high prices for those grasses, at least on the scale that we are estimating. So what we have is differing regulations. We have, in this case, the Low Carbon Fuel Standard and the federal RFS2 both include requirements to direct, indirect and direct land use change. The LCFS has specific sustainability provisions, but these different laws are not harmonized. The RFS2 is a mandate for certain fuel qualities, and the fuels have to meet certain greenhouse gas reduction limits. The LCFS is a performance standard. In other words, the lower the carbon intensity, the better the price or the better the performance within the reg. They're quite different. They have not been harmonized. And you may – oh, I'm doing that again. You may remember that – see if I can go back – that just recently a lawsuit was settled which enjoined or halted the operation of the Low Carbon Fuel Standard because in part it conflicted with the RFS2 and in part it interfered with national trade. So we have to ask about rules and regs, whether we can have a sustainable policy with the kind of rules and regs that we have and despite the kinds of rules and regs that we have. So this comes from an interesting book by a guy named Finnis on natural law and natural rights. But he may ask these questions about laws. He says they really are good laws if they you know, prospective rather than retroactive, if they're not impossible to comply with, if they're clearly promulgated, if they're clear, if they're coherent with respect to each other, if they're stable over time to be guidelines for long-term contract and conduct and administered consistently and uniformly. You have to ask yourself whether our current regulatory setting, in fact, could be characterized this way. So can we use sustainability for regulatory purposes? This is just kind of a cartoon about what sustainability is. I put these circles in here. I add human welfare, direct land use effects, greenhouse gas reductions, conservation values. We could add other elements to that circle. You could draw your own. What we seem to be doing is we're saying that the greenhouse gas reductions are the primary thing we care about, and that all other characteristics of sustainability, however we define it, first must meet these greenhouse gas reduction requirements. That means that some things that we regard as sustainable will have to be compromised. We use models for regulation. We're using them in all kinds of ways. We have to be mindful as we go forward that there is a relationship between the model you choose to some degree and the outcome that you get. This fellow from the European Union calls it an uneasy relationship. But nonetheless, if you pick a particular model, you can expect to get a certain kind of output and a certain kind of outcome. Models are also used, they're moving from research tools, things that help us frame our understanding of reality, to actual use for regulation. Now, that's been done in other regulatory areas over time before and is, but now we're talking about complex ecosystem scale processes. So we're treating them somewhat more as truth machines than simply as learning tools, and we have to be cautious about that. And lastly, we tend to try to load a lot of objectives into a single policy, and we're trying to control complex systems with policies that perhaps are not up to the task. So to finish, I'd like to just point out some kind of obvious things, I think, to everyone. First is that change, particularly with respect to agriculture, is a constant characteristic of agricultural practices. It's also true for forestry, it's true for manufacturing, but we know that change is constant. We know that policies and social preferences and external influences are in flux, and that the most important ones may be unpredictable. We know that new technology and learning occurs constantly but unevenly. So to define sustainable farming practices well or feedstock production practices well and have an effective standard for biofuel production, we have to have mechanisms that evaluate our standards and our process built in. We have to keep our standards simple, in my view, just like those first slides, but they have to also be effective. I think that we have to emphasize learning in our standards, and we have to have a dynamic and constant process for doing so. And that has to inform the regulatory process. And I think the policy should require but also financially support this capacity for learning. I think long-term research projects should be part of our task of defining what sustainability means, and they should be adequately supported, and they rarely are. They're very difficult to have funding over time and to sustain. I also think that careful local measurement is way better than using global models for determining whether a project is sustainable. And if we had more time, I would provide you an example of how we're trying to approach this in California, but perhaps for some other meeting we can go over doing that, how my group anyway is doing it. So with that, I'll end. I hope that I provide at least a few things to think about as we talk about sustainability today. We're all wondering whatever happened to those alternative sources of energy. You guys are trying to make them come about, and the sooner the better. Thank you.